that has been submitted to our committee, the Further Education and Training Colleges Amendment Bill and the Higher Education Laws Amendment Bill. We are going to hear presentations from Higher Education South Africa, FET CEO, that is the structure of employers in the Further Education and Training category, the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, the University of Stellenbosch, and the South African Student Congress. I'm going to allow members to introduce themselves accordingly, and thereafter the presenters and our guests will do so, in that way heralding the first presentation. Thank you.
My name is Crosby Moni. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education. Thank you. Actually, good morning.
Morning. My name is Mr. Hademi. Member of the Portfolio Committee.
Morning, everyone. I'm Silent Makuvela. I'm a member of this committee. Ignore what my neighbors are saying.
Good morning. My name is Alfred Ponjame, a member of this committee.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Andriques van der Weestijzen.
Good morning. Denise Koppers-Lawrence, member of the Portfolio Committee.
Let me hand over to the to the guests and
Chairperson, thank you. I must apologize for appearing before you again. I've been asked today to represent Higher Education South Africa. Professor Malata was to have joined me, but I'm not sure that he must have been delayed. I will be brief, though. Higher Education South Africa is the umbrella organization for the public universities, universities of technology, and comprehensive universities in South Africa. And collectively, Higher Education would like to make some brief submissions on the two bills before your committee, Chairperson. So the first thing, HESA supports essentially the submissions made by the University of Cape Town to your committee last week, and simply just to repeat that we believe that the clauses as framed would have unintended effects. We believe that students and members of council committees as well as council members need to be covered by the new provisions. HESA does not support the absolute prohibition about commercial transactions between the institution and staff, which would be provided were the clause inserting subsection 34A and 34.5 to be enacted. But we do recognize, Chairperson, that there are dangers, and institutional policies and procedures and the legislation must safeguard the institution and the public interest from abusive conflict of interest. So in general, the purpose of the clauses which are to combat conflict of interests in public higher education are supported. We go on then, Chairperson, to the National Financial Aid Scheme, where the bill provides powers for the minister. In essence, and I'll go through this in detail, in essence, Higher Education South Africa supports the minister having those powers, but believes that there needs to be provision for appropriate process. So the insertion of section 4A is not supported because this would grant to the minister powers to, which would effectively usurp the function of an independent juristic person. And we think that the committee needs to reframe these provisions to take that into account. Section 482, as drafted in the bill, brings into question principles of good corporate governance and fair administrative action, where the board is not provided with an opportunity to make representations or to implement remedial action within the specified time frame before unilateral determinations are made in terms of the board members. I mean, it's in essence, Chairperson, the minister must have the power to intervene, but there must be due process where he does intervene, or where she does intervene. Again, Chairperson, while 4B3 as drafted makes provision for submission from the board prior to the appointment of administrator, at that time, as the clause is worded, the directive to appoint the administrator has already been issued. And we believe, Chairperson, that the board should be able to make submissions prior to the issuing of directives. In addition, we believe that the minister should be required to furnish reasons for his conclusions upon receiving such representation in order to ensure that there's fairness, transparency and accountability in the process. Then, Chairperson, the proposed Section 7A would allow the minister very extensive powers to dissolve the board at his discretion and to appoint his administrator. And again, Higher Education South Africa believes that that is necessary, but that there must be provision for due process in the case of non-performance, and in addition that there should be guidelines regarding the expectations and conduct of the board which must be documented, and that board performance would be evaluated against those documented expectations of conduct. I think, Chairperson, the next one, as we read the clause, Section 7A1 would assume that the administrator and the board could operate concurrently. We think that that's problematic and that there should be a further power to the minister to consider dissolution if fewer than 75% of the board members resign, simply to make sure that there's clarity as to who is ruling the roost. Chairperson, then we move on to the Further Education and Training Colleges Amendment Bill. I think Higher Education South Africa supports the key object of this bill, which is to transfer these from one sphere of government to another sphere of government, in other words, from the provincial to the national. So we, in essence, Higher Education South Africa believes that that's a good thing. The replacement as the political head of the Minister of Higher Education and Training, replacing the provincial MECs, we support. And we believe that's in line with provisions applicable to higher education institutions, but more importantly, we believe that that will promote a more integrated post-secondary education sector, which must be in the interests of the country. We support Section 9, the insertion of Section 9, in respect of good governance, with the same provisos as applicable to our support of the parallel provisions that would be inserted into the Higher Education Act. The issue of staff employed by the province and others by the college, we support this because this should bring about harmonisation of staff conditions of service. But we do know, and we do draw attention to the committee chairperson, of the challenge that this is going to face, bring to the colleges where capacity questions are clear, and this is going to be an issue, a challenge for those institutions and for the department. The issue in the proposed Section 22, again, we support this provision for fair and equitable funding. There's going to be a lot of work needed to make sure that that works in practice, and the program qualification mix questions for these colleges will be important. We simply just note, Chairperson, that the NATED courses were previously excluded from the norms and standards for funding, and that sort of gap should not be allowed to continue into the future if the colleges are going to be viable in this new dispensation. We think that while the CEM, the Council of Education Ministers, will no longer be the consultative body, which is appropriate, that there may be a need for post-transitional forums. Those need not be provided for by legislation, but I think they will be needed in practice. And then just two general comments. Clearly, the bill and the way in which this operates needs to be aligned with the unfolding green paper on post-secondary education. And we believe that the bill should indicate mechanisms for initial and continuing professional staff development at FET colleges. I think it's common cause that staff capacity is not uniform in the FET colleges nationally. And even in the higher education university sector, we have felt the lack of provisions of this sort, and we believe that the committee would be doing the FET sector a favour were it to consider some provision in respect of that. So, essentially, Chairperson, we believe the bill would empower FET colleges. That's a good thing. The question of institutional capacity is an issue, and short to medium term interventions are urgently required. Again, Chairperson, that's not a matter for legislation, but it is a matter for executive and administrative action. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. I think members have had an opportunity to peruse the submissions of FISA and have also had the opportunity to hear the presentation. I have noticed that a lot of the submissions that are coming through are reflecting on the question of the conflict of interest. And I think it may be a matter that arises for us to determine. And I thought I could benefit from you in terms of your own, if we were to bring a definition of what a conflict of interest is, what elements do you think ought to be included in that? In my own imagination, I'm thinking that there are very complex ways in which people circumvent, statutory provisions. I mean, if we say it is a conflict of interest for a member of staff or a member of council to enter into business transactions with the university in which he or she serves, then that employee or member of council could simply just call the spouse to create a company of a similar nature as his, and then he recuses himself or he does not, and then that goes on. Or my children, to call upon my children, we are prohibited from entertaining business with our university. Come do business with us. Or my friends, I could simply call another powerful professor to come and do the same business, and let's help one another. Because here we would like to create stability in institutions that arise from business interests. Particularly in FETs, we are told members of council have got business interests in the college. They sit in there and know that I'm protecting my interests, and I would like to serve on this council for as many years as possible so that I could continue siphoning resources from this institution in terms of the tender processes that are undertaken in this institution. How do you help us? But that is actually the issue that we would like to address. So we would like to formulate a provision which, as you say, does not result in an unpalatable prohibition that becomes very absolute and without recognizing that there could be issues of patent which inevitably would have some professor or scholar having interest and so on.
Chairperson, thank you. I think, first of all, any regime for combating conflicts of interest requires disclosure. Disclosure of conflict of interest must disclose the personal and immediate family interests of any person who is a member of a decision-making body or any individual charged with that decision-making. Disclosure of interest then must go to first his or her and his or her immediate family's financial interests. I think that the sort of rule that many institutions have and the sort of practice that King II and King III require for publicly listed companies could be looked at in the higher education and further education sectors. But essentially there must be at least an annual disclosure in writing by any person who serves on a committee or a council or has individual authority to make decisions of her or his interests and her or his family interests. That includes not just financial interests, but fiduciary interests as well. Clearly, of course, a person who has a small shareholding in a publicly listed company of, say, less than 5% of the issued share capital, that's not a material interest that would affect his or her judgment in the matter. But in a private company, or a substantial interest in a listed company, that must be declared. That is the first requirement. The second requirement is that an institution and chairperson, from the experience of Parliament, you'll know that Parliament has such a body to which the register of MPs' interests must be recorded. Each institution, and typically it would be the registrar of that institution or somebody else nominated by the Vice-Chancellor or perhaps the auditors of that institution, must receive those declarations. And in two institutions of which I'm aware, the registrar is required to do it, but the auditors review that on an annual basis, and it's part of the audit process, and it's part of the process on which the auditors report. So declaration is the first step. Declaration in writing, at least on an annual basis, of all financial and fiduciary interests. That, I think, deals with the person who gets a spouse to front for his or her company or gets a son or a daughter to do so, because it must be those of immediate family members as well as the person concerned. Chairperson, the second thing is that there must be a provision, and your committee in the bill has provisions for council members, which we believe should be extended to committee members and to individuals charged with making decisions. There must be a requirement that those people recuse themselves from any decision in which they have an interest. And that interest may have arisen subsequent to the annual declaration, so it's not merely sufficient that the annual declaration is the issue, because somebody could obtain an interest prior to a decision being made, but subsequent to her or his annual declaration. So the requirement for a person to declare an interest if a decision is coming, to recuse, and then to be kept out of the decision-making process. That is the second issue. Chairperson, the third issue, which I think is important, is that in institutions, further education and higher education institutions, many decisions are effectively taken by delegated authority. The councils can't take all decisions of financial transactions. So that any person who has delegated authority to act must, if the proposed transaction is with a person, for example, a member of council, after interest has been declared, must not take that decision but must refer that to council. And councils must be satisfied if they're going to do business with a staff member or a student or a council member that there is good reason to do so. I'll give one example, Chairperson. A university in Gauteng, I'll not name it, there's a professor has invented a device. It's an ingenious device, but it essentially, you pass four or five of these little machines around a lecture theatre of 400 students. They each just put their finger onto it, and it makes a class registered. It means nobody can sign in for a person on that person's behalf. Well, that university has bought these devices from this staff member who developed this and set up a company. Now, that's unique. There's absolutely no corruption involved in that, and the university concerned knew that the staff member had an interest in this, and it was perfectly above board. That sort of thing, I think, you know, has to be allowed, but it has to be done on the basis that everybody knows, full disclosure, this is the staff member, he has an interest, this is his company, he will make profits from it, but it's in the university's interest to do so. So that, Chairperson, I hope very briefly helps you. In the submission that I made wearing a different hat last week, I did draw attention to the fact that in the institutional statute of the University of Cape Town, there is an express provision for this. And it may be that institutions may wish to adopt either internal rules or adopt such provisions actually in the institutional statute that go further than the legislation would do, detailing the practices that must apply in the institution concerned.
Other members, if you would like to interact with the presentation, this is the opportunity.
What is HESA's approach regarding the fact that Section 23 is repealed? You haven't made any mention of Section 23.
That will be of the NSFAS Act.
Yes.
HESA is perfectly accepted, perfectly happy with the repeal of that section.
Any further inputs, Khadab?
Thank you. I just want to get a clarity here in terms of your submission that you think the around the your section of the NFR that you think the intervention of the minister will be an unfair intervention in terms of the I don't know what page it is on, but it's your section 2 in your NSFAS. Your last paragraph there, or your last sentence line, it's 1, 2, 3, 4. From the broad nature of the criteria of the intervention by the minister, it's set out under the section 4A, 1A, 2F. And the consequent scope for that creates the undefeated arbitrary intervention by the minister. I need to get a clear clarification in terms of what I'm trying to say exactly. Because my understanding is that when the minister trying to intervene when there are challenges in terms of the NSFAR distribution, he intervened because, you know, there are also outcries that, you know, these finances are not distributed correctly, or are not, you know, fairly being given to the deserved children.
Chairperson, first of all, let me make it clear that HESA believes that the minister who is politically accountable for NSFAS must have the power to intervene. He must have the power to intervene, for example, to dissolve the board. He must have the power, if necessary, to appoint an administrator. We're not disputing that. Public money is involved, the interests of students are involved, and the minister is politically accountable for that and therefore must have the power to act and must be answerable for HESA, for NSFAS. He can't be answerable for NSFAS unless he has power to intervene. However, if he appoints a board, and if that board appoints executive officers, before the minister intervenes, there must be due process. That's all we're saying.
Just on the students having a conflict of interest financially. When we're talking of council, in the main, it's the understanding that they're dealing with issues of governance in that institution. I do agree that even those members who are students there representing their own sector, they will be covered. Now, the understanding here is to try and propagate for that to go beyond the council to SRC, for instance, which may as well be dealing with that. But I take it that within the institution, it may not just be the two bodies. There may be critical, but it may not just be council and SRC. Are we arguing that there's no other body in the institution that deals with issues of finances or transactions that may have conflict of interest to the extent that we want all of them covered by the bill?
Chairperson, precisely, we believe that the clauses need to be amended to make provision in the Act to cover council, committees of council, and other bodies inside an institution that make decisions. If I could give two examples. In most institutions, many of the decisions relating to building projects will be made by a building or an estates committee. which will have authority delegated to it by council. The decisions to appoint professionals and to award construction contracts will be made by those committees, and the members of those committees must be subject to the same regime on conflict of interest as would apply to a council member. Secondly, all public higher education institutions are very largely democratized. And if, for example, a university is awarding a catering contract for its student housing, it is going to involve students in the committees that oversee the decisions to award a catering contract. And there will be staff members, and there may be council members, and there may be independent consultants. All of the members of such a committee would, in our view, Chairperson, need to be subject to whatever regime is in place to guard conflict of interest.
Meaning that we must broaden the section, not necessarily as articulated in Asia Doctor.
Thank you, Chairperson. Last week, the presenter wearing a different hat was so kind to, in some cases, offer an alternative wording for some of the clauses, which is now still done. And I'm just inquiring whether you would be willing to do the same for those clauses where you have made some recommendations regarding amending those clauses, etc. Not obviously where clauses ought to be scrapped, because I think that would avoid the situation where, you know, the final wording may still not be meeting what the point is that you're trying to achieve in terms of your inputs. So do you think that is something which we would be able to ask of you? And I think, Chairperson, we've said that we would like perhaps to meet on Friday again with such a tight timeline, allow you to assist us in this respect.
Chairperson, I assume the Honourable Member is referring to the provisions which we believe should be inserted to provide for due process where the Minister intervenes. We would have a go at doing that. I think we could get it to you by tomorrow evening, if that would help. I don't presume that we in HESA have all the drafting skills necessary for this, but we at least make an attempt.
We have the state law advisors and the parliamentary services with us. They are here to really hear what you say, and they are going to be helping the committee with very specialized skills. Coin whatever provisions we would like to see at the end. But I think such an intervention might as well help, so that we could consider it. Thank you for your presentation. I am going to call for a presentation from FET CEO, if they're here, then they could come forward. If they are not yet here, then I'm going to call the NSFAS. I can see the chairperson of the body here. You can come over, sir. I'll remain silent. You can, Professor Thomas, you cannot see in the meantime. You cannot see in the meantime working tea whilst you are installing our systems. You cannot work in tea in the meantime while still trying to install our systems.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and members of the Portfolio Committee. My name is Mike Masuluke. I'm presenting on behalf of the Further Education and Training Colleges Employer Organization. And with me, I have Mr. Jimmy Manyobi, who's also a leader, national leader of the same organization. Maybe in starting, let me indicate, Chair, and apologize for the delay by disclosing interest. Let me indicate that we are actually technologically challenged. You'll understand that colleges are given the task to produce skills, but one thing that colleges failed to do was to assist its leaders in terms of empowering them with the technological know-how. So my apologies for the delay. Thank you, Chair. Firstly, the organization would like to first commend the Minister of Higher Education, Dr. Blake Nzimande, for the high level of commitment displayed in the quest to transform the FET sector into an excellent hub for skills development. The organization appreciates the colossal strides taken by the Minister to appropriately mainstream the sector and ensure that it responds adequately to the challenges of the developing country. However, while recognizing that certain strides have been made in transforming our education system, certain things still remain critical in our agenda of realizing our goals as a developmental state. There is a need to focus our energies as a collective to policies, legislation, programs, acts, and other regulatory frameworks within the sector to ensure their relevance in driving the noble agenda of skills development and training in South Africa. We support the Department of Higher Education and Training in its bid to locate the public FET college sector within a single policy and legal framework to ensure maximum provision of training and post-compulsory education. Let me indicate that in terms of the FET Act of 2006, that created colleges as employers. Colleges then agreed to establish an organization that will represent them on bargaining matters and also policy advocates. That is where the FAT CEO was established. You will recall that there were so many challenges in the sector, most especially in relation to the issues of salaries, disparity, salaries of employees in the sector. When we took over, one, the teachers who now became lecturers were not beneficiaries of the collective agreements that were reached in the ELRC. And there was not even an OSD in the sector. The FETCO was then recognized as the employer representing colleges in the ELRC FETC bargaining unit, and as well as in the GPSSBC FETC bargaining unit. However, you will agree that as funds are still with the state, we're the employer that does not hold the purse, except for college-employed staff members. Therefore, we highly welcome the move by the department to relieve us from this nightmare that we had to inherit in order to be able to concentrate and put more focus on key governance issues. But I must indicate that we tried our level best, hence we have never had any industrial action in FET sector, despite the challenges that we were facing as a sector. We welcome the move to take back the employment of staff by department, and we also want to indicate that the current negotiated settlement in the sector created equality between employees who were employed in terms of post funded by the department and those that were employed in college funded post. That was done with the understanding that there is currently one employer in the sector, and that was colleges. And there will be no legal justification of any artificial division of employees in colleges. We have noted some few challenges in the bill that we believe must bring to the attention of the portfolio committee. One, the bill suggests that the appointment and or transfer of staff shall be dealt with in terms of the Public Service Act. While this matter is legally correct, since there is no other alternative, it however has the following challenges. One, it may mean that the Public Service Act needs to be amended to provide deviation that allows the Minister of Higher Education and Training to determine conditions of service of staff appointed by the Minister of Higher Education and Training. Otherwise, it's not clear how the Minister of Higher Education and Training shall have jurisdiction over staff appointed in terms of the PSA without the consent of the Minister of Public Service and Administration. Both lecturers and support staff appointees of the Minister appointed in terms of Section 20, Subsection 2B, lecturers and support staff shall provisionally have their conditions of service dealt with in the same bargaining council, and that is currently the GPSSBC. This matter is made clear in paragraph 9 of the transitional measures. It should be noted that this will change the current sectoral bargaining arrangement. Section 20, subsection 4B allows councils to appoint staff additional to the minister appointees. It is clear that the support staff component will have their conditions of service determined in the GPSSBC. However, paragraph 10 of the transitional measure suggests that conditions of service of concerned employees appointed in terms of Section 24B shall be dealt with in the ELRC. And we believe that this situation will create disparity in the sector, in that already the bill resolves that conditions of service of lecturers appointed by the minister will be dealt with in the GPSSBC. We think the possible solutions will be, one, allow the bill to go through and later the Minister of Higher Education and Training petition the Minister of Public Service and Administration to allow for deviation in the same way it was done for educators in schools, to the point that their conditions of service are now dealt with in terms of the EEA in the ELRC.
or to insert a section in the bill that empowers the Minister of Higher Education and Training and possibly the FET CEO that represents college councils to determine the conditions of service of the appointees in the relevant respective bargaining councils. All support staff in the GPSS BCs, lecturers in the ELRC, and transversal issues in the PSCBC. We'll also advocate for the Service Act solely for the FET sector, where both the Department of Higher Education and Training and the College Council represented by the FET CEO are the recognized employers, as we have noted that the uniqueness of the sector will always require colleges to employ staff in non-department funded posts. In order to attract skilled personnel in colleges, we need a salary dispensation that is fully dedicated to the sector. We must also indicate that the bill in itself still creates two sets of employers in the sector, where it allows for recognition of the minister in the bargaining chamber, but at the same time it says college councils must employ and still bargain in the same bargaining chamber. We therefore believe that it will be of great assistance if the bill also compels colleges to act together like the current arrangement, where bargaining will be centralized instead of individual colleges going to a bargaining chamber. Imagine 50 councils bargaining differently. That will create a nightmare in colleges. And we must understand and agree that the current setup is a voluntary setup in colleges, but I think legislation must come and assist so that we don't have certain colleges that will go and bargain whilst others actually are not doing the line. The bill reaffirmed the role of college councils as key governance structures in colleges, and we also welcome the quest to discourage tender, if I may borrow that word, tender pioneerism in colleges and also to uproot corruption. We believe that the issue of disclosure must be a fundamental issue that ensures good governance in college councils and college, in FET colleges, in all structures. We have noted and welcomed the introduction of the PFMA in the sector and believe that this will assist in giving governance structures the power to hold management accountable in financial decision made rather than just approval of budget. I must indicate that this was actually a nightmare, because currently, if there are some financial challenges as council, when you want to hold management accountable, there's also an issue of PFMA. Others will tell you that PFMA does not apply in colleges when it suits them, and when it does not suit them, they will now go back to the same PFMA. So I think the insertion of this in the Act will assist the governance structures in colleges in order to hold management accountable. We also believe that as it is the case with higher education, with ESA, we also believe that the bill should find space to locate the FET CEO either in the current form or in any other form in order to create space for centralized bargaining and any other advocacy role in the sector. On that note, Chair, I thank you. I'll then ask. Okay, thank you. I thank you, Chair.
I think from the presentations that we received so far from the FET sector, there was concern about dualism that you mentioned, that what is the rationale of having the minister as the employer and the college as the employer? Maybe the department would clarify whether they are happy with that environment where there are basically two employers, the college and the minister. Maybe we need to reconcile that aspect. And the second aspect that has also come out very forthrightly is the aspect of bargaining structures as to where will they be placed, in the ELRC or in the General Public Service Central Bargaining Council and so on. And those are the issues which must be clarified tomorrow once and for all for us to be able to take a stand as Parliament. The questions that also arose related to conditions of service. I mean the organized labor seemed to suggest that they should find expression. However, we think those aspects belong to the executive. It must be properly resolved to ensure that the interests of the sector are looked at differentially, given the fact that they would like to be looked at as such, so that they must not be looked as, I mean, any other employee. I think those are the things which we will compile for the relevant branch of government, and we will deal with our aspect quite effectively. Members, can I take this moment to allow you to interact with the presentation? Jason?
Thank you. Thank you. Chairperson, one of the main motivations for changing the employer from that of the College Council to that of the Minister is because colleges have not been empowered to act as employers. There were particular problems, administrative problems, financial problems, etc. Now, in this legislation, the College Council will still remain an employer, but for a smaller number of people. My question is just, do you believe that the College Councils will have the capacity to administer the smaller payroll if they have been unable to administer the bigger one? Secondly, sir, your point about the conditions of service is taken note of. Is it also your understanding that in terms of the transitional arrangements, current college staff members will remain with their current service conditions, but that new appointees, as it stands at present, will have to be on campus for 40 hours a week, and will only be entitled in terms of the leave dispensation as to that of all other public service staff? Thank you. Sorry, Chair, the point that I'm trying to make is that we will have in one organization people working shoulder to shoulder with one another whose conditions of service will differ and also whose employer will differ, and I would like you just to comment on the wisdom of that. Thank you.
Gina?
Thank you, Chair. My question will go to the two possible resolve parties that they came up with on the issues of the two bargaining council and the two employees when it comes to college staff and lecturers, as to say, really, are those the only two that you could come up with? Because looking at the second one, I don't think, from the presentation that you have made, I think what we are calling for is that we have one bargaining council, one employer when it comes to the college lecturers, because we're talking of numbers and yes, the conditional services where these things can be discussed. Just to say, other than changing, because we know going the route of changing the Public Service Act, yes, I don't say it's not possible, but you know the time that it can take. What are other possible ideas that you can come up with? Because we don't want to go to the place where we saw the suffering of the college staff that has happened before. I'm not pouring my view here, because I really, where we can go back to having two employers, two bargaining counters, it's quite a problem. But I think we are here to discuss on those things as to how can we resolve it. As a committee, yes, we're still going to sit down, we discuss, but we want to hear more of the ideas that are coming up so that we can sit and consolidate. And that is where we can even pour our ideas, of which I don't think it's the platform for that now. We're just listening as to what is it. But I'm not that I'm not satisfied, but I still think there are more of the ideas that we can pour there, because as for it, there is only one now that you can work on what you have resolved here. But I think maybe we have reserved some of the things. Just the thinking, just throw them in. You are not saying, there's nothing binding as to say this is what you said, but you are playing around with ideas so that at the end we can make the informed decisions that we have got. Thank you.
I think the last question and the last question raised by the honorable member of the committee, let me link the two questions, because I believe they are similar. They point to the same challenge. What we are saying, or the experience, let me first talk of the experience that we experienced in this sector, was that the act itself, the current act that we have in place, instructed the colleges to bargain in the ELRC bargaining chamber for conditions of service of the lecturing staff, and also in the GPSSBC for conditions of service of the support staff. It further said that up until there is an agreement to form a single bargaining unit. That in itself, I must indicate that it created a serious nightmare in the sector. Because, one, we had to agree that when we inherited this set of employees, they have lost out in the current or the conditions of service that were there in the teaching mainstream. We then had to agree to equalize. But in the process of equalizing, in our engagement with the department then, the rationale that were given behind the exclusion of this set of employees was that the sector must have its own unique conditions of service. But I must disclose that didn't materialize. Because firstly, we had to look at equalization, creating parity, and that took much of our time. So, when I look at the bill itself, it's still creating the same nightmare. The division of employees. Coming back to the question, I think the possible solution will be a creation, even though we agree that the sector is very small, but a creation of a bargaining chamber that is solely dedicated to the FET sector. That will include both set of employees, that is the support staff in colleges, as well as the lecturers in colleges. And in that bargaining chamber, you are going to have the two set of employers, that is the department, as well as college council. So sitting here, I think that could be the possible solution to our problem. Now, on the issue of the employees that are employed by colleges, we must agree that colleges whether we have one employer, that being the minister, there are situations that requires colleges to employ staff, either on temporal basis, others as replacement. So still, we are going to still have colleges as employers. We cannot run away from that. And I think, if you recall, before the promulgation of the current act, you also had two sets of employers in the college sector. But the only challenge that was there was that those that were employed by college councils, their conditions of service were not negotiated anywhere. Now, when we created parity in the sector, we realized that there were problems. I must disclose that in some cases, the post provision, you find that a person is allocated a particular title, but when you look at the salary that that person is given, it does not reflect to the position that this person is. So we have to equalize first. And we agree that we have created a legitimate expectation by equalizing the conditions of service and salaries of those that are employed by college councils directly and paid by colleges, and those that are paid in college-funded or state-funded posts. You cannot run away from that. We have created the legitimate expectation. Even if we move to the new dispensation, there will be that expectation from the set of employees that colleges will employ. Who will then say that we are in the same sector. We want the same conditions, we want the same salary parity. So that's why we believe that there is capacity in colleges, there will be capacity. Ours is to ensure that we build that capacity in colleges. We cannot run away that colleges, of the fact that colleges must and will still remain as employees for this small portion of employees. I think that's covered. I don't know if... Yeah, that's an addition to...
Thanks, Chair. Just on two things, Patana Masulink. One, I just want to understand it's page 12, the last paragraph of your presentation, talks of a salary dispensation that is solely dedicated to the sector. And in the bill, we're talking of the creation of a new structure if you have gone through that. Are you in agreement with that, or you believe it should be something different? I'm not sure if you have got the deal with you there, but it will be on page 14, section 24B of the Principal Act as amended by this Act. Until the parties agree to establish a new structure relevant to support staff of public colleges. I'm not sure whether we're talking about the same thing or you have got a different understanding of that. The second part is in the bill, we're talking about the merger, the merging of colleges. My interest will be on whether in the merging of colleges that has been witnessed or happened before, were there particular experiences that you wanted in terms of procedures and policy-wise included in the bill, or you just satisfied with that section as proposed?
Chair, let's first have an understanding. The conditions of service that lecturers are working on right now are not for the FET. They come from the EEA, Employment of Educators Act. So that does not address the problems that the lecturing staff is facing. And not forgetting also what the minister says he envisaged. A 24/7 college that will be running day and night to skill our people. You cannot have then the EEA being used as the conditions of service of lecturing staff. That's why in our presentation we say we would like to have a dispensation where it is only solely on the FET. So that the other issue that the Honorable Gina raised of having two sectors of staff, others working 40 hours, others working 35, you can't have that situation. We are trying to eradicate that situation. And we can only do so by removing this artificial separations that are there now. So that lecturing, FET staff knows that they are FET staff. And educators are educators. So that is what we are trying to address. I'm sure once we have we come with that, we'll have addressed the biggest challenge that the FET sector is facing. Right now, you cannot tell lecturers to work more than what they are working. As soon as you begin to say that, then they want overtime, they want a lot of things which you cannot then afford.
We are agreeing that the employment conditions of the workers in the sector must be harmonized, and that there must not be any prejudice arising out of these amendments we are engaged with, and that there must be a bargaining center for this sector. And those are issues beyond Parliament. It is the executive that determines such matters. And I'm very hard pressed to mention this. Now, it would seem that we are now bargaining with the sector in Parliament, which is not the right place. But we have noted the concerns and we will articulate them to the executive that, in fact, the workers are looking at this kind of an environment. When we meet the department, we will still say to them, look, what kind of structure do you think will be relevant? But we hear the stakeholders are saying this, and we will persuade them. We may not take a decision for them because it is not within our right to do so. It's like trying to produce a judgment in Parliament, you know, when it is the judiciary that must do so. Now, but we are clear about that. We have noted those issues. And we will interact with them accordingly. I think that's what I should say on behalf of the committee. Well, I think both the employer organization and the unions agree in principle and generally on the issue. We, yes.
As a follow-up, you know, when we listen even to other inputs, that clarity is key. Other stakeholders will say, instead of a new structure, we think there should be, perhaps if there will be need, some arrangements, and we must leave it not necessarily as a forceful thing in the bill to think there's a need for a new structure. And I was trying to understand from the employers here whether they're talking of that structure or they have got another thinking around that so that we know how, you know, the popularity of that within the bill as captured now, or if it's not as popular, because several stakeholders are against that, and no. But that's all I needed to solicit from this. Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe let us be clear that the current setup creates challenges to both the employer and the employees in the college. Because we don't have a bargaining sector that is solely dedicated to the FET sector. When you go to the ELRC for argument's sake, you are a very small unit within the ELRC. You also meet the same negotiators who also negotiate for the mainstream in the ELRC. So you meet a lot of challenges in as much as you will want to improve conditions of service in the sector. There is a conflict of interest. So we want to indicate, I think, if the bill can, rather than say may, parties may agree, or parties agree, the bill, if the new act instructs parties to form a single bargaining unit, instead of leaving it to parties to agree. Because that in itself, it will come as an instruction that you will need to form a bargaining unit that is solely dedicated for the sector.
I think let's park that aspect. It is going to be one of the aspects that we're going to discuss. We have parked it. It is a very important issue. Then we'll go to the third presentation by Ernest Fass. I must thank the presenters for their helpful approach to the issues as articulated in the bill. So we'll take into consideration the submissions, and I think they'll sharply influence discussions of members tomorrow's meeting. Yeah.
Good morning, Chairperson, and honorable members, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for this opportunity given to the National Student Financial Aid Scheme to make a presentation to this to you this morning on higher education laws and amendment bill. I must say that NSFAS has a direct interest in the amendments of the NSFAS Act 56 of 1999 proposed in the bill. I'm here this morning. My name is Samaedo Sokaise. I'm the chairperson of the board of NSFAS, and I'm accompanied by my colleague, Mr. Paul Benjamin. Mr. Paul Benjamin is the legal advisor to the board of NSFAS. Paul is going to take us through in terms of the submission that we have made, and we'll be also be prepared to take questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks. All right. Ms. Fass's comments concentrate on the proposal to repeal Section 23 of the NSFAS Act. However, just to indicate in paragraph 2 of our comments, and this just does indicate that it supports the proposed amendments to the Act to empower the Minister to intervene in cases of FUR or non-performance by the Board, and submits that these amendments will contribute to the achievement of good corporate governance at NSFAS. All right, with regard to the proposed amendment to Section 23, NSFAS accepts that the clause as it stands is unconstitutional. It's not arguing that. Its submission is rather the following. Section 23 was put in for a purpose, and that was to facilitate the recovery of loans. This FAS's view that to merely repeal it is the classic syndrome of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. In this FAS's view, Section 23 can be revised to render it constitutional. And that's really the purpose of the submission, to indicate, in our view, how that can be achieved. Just to indicate that as a result of its concerns about the constitutionality of Section 23, NSFAS has not used it where people have not consented to deductions. So as a result of its concerns, NSFAS does not currently make new repayment arrangements using Section 23 in recovering debts from any borrower employed in either the private or public sector who has not consented to their employer making a reduction. So we've respected that view. NSFAS is of the view that a clause such as Section 23 is necessary. It needs an efficient constitutional and legally compliant manner of recovering debts. And bearing in mind that NSFAS, as you know, the scale of the recovery is immense, and it's a range of relatively small sums from a very large number of people. The amendments we propose will cure the constitutional invalidity. In terms of our proposal, Section 23 in particular, no deduction should be made without the written consent of the borrower. As you know, that the major criticism is that Section 23 allows the employer to make the deduction without any reference to the employee. And we accept that consent should be required. To indicate further, it's NSFAS's experience, this is paragraph 6, that many borrowers, when faced with the prospect of NSFAS notifying the employer that they have failed to repay a student loan, consent to the deduction being made by their employer. So most borrowers want to repay, and they certainly don't want a situation where it somehow sours their relationship with their employer. So Section 23, as amended, would continue to serve this purpose, that is, recovering loans without the cost for both NSFAS and the employee of going to court. Just to indicate the scale of the issue, in the period from 2000 to 2010, the amounts recovered under Section 23 were $350 million through the private employers and $1.4 billion through the state personnel system. The practice of NSFAS was to notify employers of its intention to use Section 23 to recover loans and then to allow the employer to obtain consent. However, within the public sector, the practice was merely to instruct personnel to commence deductions based on the published scale. So the current amounts being recovered are about $3.6 million from 6,000 individuals in the private sector and about $25 million a month in the public sector. NSFAS has been in communication with the Accountant General because of its concerns, and the Accountant General has expressed the view that NSFAS should obtain written consent from each borrower prior to deductions in the public sector through the personnel system. In each case, written consent would have to be preceded by a process to ascertain, among other things, the affordability of the proposed repayment. And one of the considerations there is obviously the National Credits Act. However, once this process is fully implemented, it is MISFAS believes it will increase its recovery. And obviously this will allow for the situation where less new money has to be made available to MISFAS. All right, so the amendment proposed, there are three amendments, and I've given you, have you got it with you, we just reworked chapter 4 that deals with the loans in the statutory amendment language form. So the first proposal is in fact in respect of section 21. Have you all got that with, have the members got that before them? Okay, so with regard to section 21, section 21 is a clause that is there. It allows people who default to be placed on lists in the normal process. And although this is not proposed in the bill, MISFAS does propose an amendment to section 21(4)(b) that the borrower protections be extended by requiring MISFAS, before it utilizes section 21, to give the person a reasonable opportunity to indicate, to either pay up or to indicate why they're not indebted. And if you bear in mind with the MISFAS claim, the MISFAS process, there are only really two issues. The one is it's the wrong person, so you may, you know, MISFAS may be trying to recover your brother's loans from you or your cousin who has the same name. Loans from you, that would be the one defense, and the other would be about the amount. So it's a relatively simple matter. They're not complex legal issues that arise. So in terms of 21, we propose this amendment to make sure that before section 21 is used, the borrower has an opportunity to show that they're not indebted or that the amount is incorrect. Then to move on to section 23, the proposal there is very similar. So at the moment, section 23, basically it's a provision that says when MISFAS notifies an employer that one of its employees owes MISFAS money, the employer must make the deduction. This proposal is to restructure it in the following way, to say when MISFAS gives notification to the employer that one of its employees is indebted, and bearing in mind this will only be used where the employee is not, where the borrower is not playing ball and paying in terms of the initial agreement, then there's an obligation on the employer to seek the consent of the employee to the deduction. So the obligation is changed from being one where the employer must make the deduction to one where the employer must set in motion a process to obtain the employee's consent to a deduction. So that's a very common process that we know with lots of deductions that would be made. So within 7 days, the employer should approach the employee saying, I've got a request from MISFAS. They want, you know, 500 rand a month to be deducted. Do you consent to that? If the employee consents, then the deduction process starts. So section 23 is changed in two ways. Firstly, it becomes a voluntary process. If the employee doesn't consent, Section 23 cannot be used. And secondly, the provision that that made it a criminal offence for an employer not to comply with an MISFAS request has been dropped. I think we don't think that's appropriate. It's never been used, and This is not something that should be criminalized. So it's allowing, so the reduction system, which has to date operated by consent, that practice is now incorporated in the Act. The result is that we say that Section 23 is not unconstitutional, because all it's enabling is a deduction by consent, and as such, no constitutional rights are affected. If the employee doesn't wish to consent, NSFAS will obviously have to resort to legal remedies. The new proposal that NSFAS has made is reflected in the Section 23A, and perhaps after I've made these comments we can find the actual text that we've drafted and go through the wording. Section 23A is based on a type of clause that's quite common in our law. As you'll see, it's found in the Income Tax Act, the Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Diseases Act, Closed Corporations Act, and the Value Added Tax Act. And it's really a form of expedited legal proceeding to recover money. And what it really enables is that if a borrower doesn't want to pay, they won't agree to the deduction or whatever, then we suggest that NSFAS's first duty is to set in motion the National Credit Agreements Act procedures, so which requires an attempt to reach an agreement involving inter alia debt counselling. It's a clause that's very protective of borrowers' rights, as you're aware. It's a very progressive clause. If the borrower is obstructive, not cooperative, doesn't feel an obligation to refund the money, then NSFAS will say we need a debt counselling process to try and reach an agreement. If that process doesn't reach an agreement, then NSFAS at some point may have no option but to institute legal proceedings. And we suggest that NSFAS should be entitled to follow the same process as SARS and organizations such as the Compensation Commissioner. And that is really to, legal proceedings are commenced by means of the issue of a statement which is confirmed by the court. So NSFAS would present as for instance the receiver of revenue does, a statement indicating the outstanding loan, any interest accrued on it, goes to the registrar of the court. The registrar approves that, provided it meets the formal requirement and it's served by the deputy sheriff on the borrower. At that point, that has the effect of a court order. Now, you may say that sounds a bit dramatic, but in fact, if you look at what it means, and this is what was dealt with in the Metcash case, a well-known constitutional court judgment of Judge Crickler, where these provisions in the VAT Act were challenged. He said, no, these type of provisions do not undermine the right of access to court in terms of Section 34 of the Constitution, because the person on whom the statement is served is entitled to apply for rescission if there is an error. And that satisfies access to court requirements. So rescission is a common application where there's an error, and again, for instance, if it's served on the wrong person, if the amounts are incorrect, the borrower on whom it is received then has, I think it's 6 weeks in terms of the magistrate's court rules, to apply for rescission. And then it's rescinded. That is a cheaper process and a quicker process from both the perspective of NSFAS and the borrower than normal court proceedings. And that's why you have a clause like that in the SARS Act, not to deprive people of rights, but because of the very clear nature of these claims. So we suggest that this is a provision that is well known in our law. It's operated for many years in a number of acts. It has to operate in a constitutionally compliant manner. The additional protection of compliance with the National Credit Act has been built in, and we think for the odd case where the borrower is uncooperative, it's appropriate that this procedure should be there. It's also bearing in mind laws have provisions that may never be used, but they have a symbolic effect and they have a deterrent effect. And somebody who has borrowed money, perhaps a young lawyer, borrowed money, thinks they might get away with it, and they see Section 23A and they say, no, I'm going to agree to an agreement to repay. So it's more for that purpose, to indicate NSFAS is serious about recovery. The social goal of providing people to access education is best served when those who've had the benefit of education repay their loans, and therefore it's quite consistent with that purpose. So that's really the suggestion. So in a sense, NSFAS has three different, it has an arsenal. But perhaps arsenal is not a word we should use any longer as an indication of competence. it has three different powers. The Section 21 powers to list, the Section 23 powers for the deduction, and the Section 23A powers to proceed to court if necessary. And we believe that will result in a situation where there is a higher recovery of loans, and that serves the purpose of the Act. So that's NSFAS's submissions to the committee, and we're certainly open to take any questions from the committee here.
Our members, you can interact with the submission. NSFAS says they agree that Section 23 as it stands is an overgrowth. So they think, though as it is an overgrowth, you don't have to knock off the teeth because you think you might just chisel them properly to be within the frame of the mouth. Now, that's what we are trying to do here. They are differing with the position that you must repeal the entire section as suggested in the bill. Any comments and inputs?
Explain to us, you refer to Section 34 of the Constitution and the infringement of the employer. Yeah. Could you just please give us a proper explanation as to...
Section 34 is the right of access to court. As Section 23 reads at the moment, so in its unamended form, what happens is NSFAS has the power, it doesn't use this power, but it has the power to issue a notice to an employer saying you must deduct 500 Rand from employee X's wages every month and pay it over to us. The employee, in the clause itself, there's no right to challenge that. So the employee's consent is not necessary. So it's clear that it probably violates other provisions, but it certainly violates. NSFAS may have made a mistake. NSFAS may have, have confused identities. There's no forum for that dispute to be resolved about the application of Section 23. So that's why we accept, and NSFAS took an opinion on this, 10 years ago. NSFAS accepts that is not acceptable, and its practice has never been that. So that's what we're saying, and this is, as a result, the recommendation came out of the committee report on NSFAS, the task force report. Subsequently, in a sense, NSFAS has considered the constitution and said, let's not lose a procedure entirely let's rather adapt it so it is constitutional.
Input? I think the presentation is straightforward. I jokingly asked last week how this act encroaches on the rights in the Constitution. Section 34 is suggested because it does not preclude a student to approach a court of law, for instance, from my perspective. And I know you've got a very good judgment, which if we were privy to, I'm sure it's going to be a very interesting exercise for us to hear from the perspective of your senior counsel who had advised you that way and so on. And I noted also that, in fact, your proposal is in line with the ministerial testing recommendation. Yes, the department went a little further to eliminate the section and so on. No, that's fine. Thank you for your presentation. I'll allow the whip again just to make a comment, then we can take the next presentation.
Let me say, really, it's on a very lighter note, but I think where the debtor has been put on the list on default, and I'm interested on the reasonable time, you know, that's a reasonable opportunity where she or he can come up and make sure that he corrects that. What is the reasonable opportunity? How much is that?
Yes, that's always been the language. We haven't proposed any amendment. But certainly now it would have to include the credit agreement, the National Credit Act processes. And those take, as I understand it, certainly up to 2 months. So you couldn't... there's no way that NSFAS could just do this without following the Section 129 procedure in the National Credit Act. So it's going to take at least 2 months to do.
So we can also take maybe a different approach ourselves and say in line with the National Credit Act.
I would leave it as it is. It hasn't caused any problems.
Yeah. It hasn't been anyhow.
And the difficulty of setting a limit is, you know, you get the hard luck cases on either side. I think it's clear, and this is not, you know, you're not regulating someone who's trying to take advantage of vulnerable people or something. This is a relationship which is conducted with respect, and I think this indication to allow the opportunity is quite adequate in these circumstances. I wouldn't go making an additional amendment there. That's our view.
Obviously, they don't want to specify a period. Generally, the opportunity will understand the context of the National Credit Act and the reasons in each case. Let me thank you for your presentation. I think we're going to take into consideration your submissions. And thank you for coming.
Thank you,
Dr. Okay. And we are going to take the University of Stellenbosch, if they are here. And if they are not here, we are going to take a presentation from SASCO. Then you can come forward and make your presentation.
In fact, it's for so many of them, all the presentations. I just the one that he has here has all been bought at the end.
Thank you, Sebastian. My name is Mbulelo Mandlana. I happen to be the president of the South African Student Council. If I had President Comrade Chaverson, I would go through the presentation as a whole, but I suppose it may not be absolutely helpful to do so, except to focus on the areas that we speak to the direct proposed amendments to the existing legislation. However, we must highlight the fact that we as expected of us, firstly in the introduction present the our understanding of the context within which these proposed transformations occur in relation to first the matters of governance and the transformation in general. We also make the assertion about the fact that those aspects in the proposal that relate to regulation of the conduct of members of councils of universities are long overdue. While they are long overdue, we also say that they are insufficient in as far as we are concerned, because they don't regulate the other areas of participation, including accountability and related areas. Thirdly, we also contextualize these changes within the long-standing principle that the real reason why we must speak of transformation in governance, in councils, in senates, and so on and so forth, is for the sole reason that we must reach some sort of a social consensus on the true meaning of what we call democratization of institutional governance, the putting into effect of the notion of cooperative governance, and lastly, the attempt to utilize that concept within the continued effort of those who are in agreement with us that institutions can no longer continue to be ivory towers but must be accountable to what is identified as a mission or a goal of all of us in the broader transformation. And lastly, we make the point that the white paper of 1997, although in itself sufficient in the bigger scheme of things as a policy context for transformation in education, it does not, however, provide some of the necessary directives in as far as how we can manage and run our councils, manage and run the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. Those are the things that you mentioned in the major things, not the only things. So as far as we're concerned, the amendments relate, and I think this is well clear to members, the regulation of conduct of council members and staff members of higher education institutions engaging in business institutions concerned. Secondly, to adjust the period within which an independent assessor may be appointed by the minister, who is appointed by the minister may finalize an investigation. Amendment to NSFAS Act to empower the minister to intervene in the case of poor performance or maladministration by the board of NSFAS, and so on and so forth. Firstly,
on the regulation of the conduct of council members and staff members of an higher education institution engaging in business with the institution concerned, we propose the following. That we are in agreement with the amendments proposed from section 27, subsection 7A to E on the members of council, including an inserted 7A and 7B. These sections reinforce the sense of duty, the fiduciary duty that members of council have towards the institution. This will agree with the proviso, and I think this must put quite clearly, that in the same section, a provision ought to be inserted, tabulating a sanction and or a procedure towards such a sanction, where a member of council had failed to comply with the new laws herein referred to as amendments, with particular reference to the duty to declare conflict of interest and recuse oneself from council meeting when an obligation arises as a consequence of this legislation. Secondly, we also endorse unconditionally the amendments of Section 34 of the Higher Education Act that relates to staff of the university. We are in agreement that the provision that the provision of the new two inserted subsections 4 and 5 is agreed to, as we said. Same with the section 27 in the bullet point above. We do so with the proviso that in the same section a provision ought to be inserted tabulating a sanction for staff members in the same way as it does with council members. For staff members, tabulating a sanction or a procedure towards such a sanction where a member of the university staff failed to comply with the new laws herein referred to as the amendments. This is in relation to the matter relating to regulation of conduct of council members and staff members around the matter of dealing with the conflict of interest and business of the university. Adjustment to period within which an independent assessor appointed by the minister must finalize investigation. On the proposed submission, we submit the following, that we are not in opposition to the extension of the time from 30 days to 90 days that the independent assessor may be given in light of the complexity provided for and the bigger merged institutions' complexities and the greater challenges that are experienced by these institutions, in light as well of the fact that in the recent past we have seen an unbundling of a merger situation. It points to the bigger limitations that sometimes we were not able to foresee. The third issue, intervention by the minister in the case of poor or non-performance or maladministration by the board of NSFAS, as we know it. We submit the following. That we note the intended amendments to the NSFAS Act that seek to empower the minister to intervene on the specified instances of deficiency attributable to the NSFAS board. That we believe that there is great credit to the idea that the Minister of Higher Education must, as a principle, play a role where there are discrepancies with either the functionality of the board or its capacity to demonstrable intention to execute its mandate. That we believe that there must be no fundamental discord in legislative terms between the manner in which the minister relates to university councils and the manner in which the minister relates to the NSFAS board in the instance of non-performance of legislated mandate or maladministration and so on and so forth. There must be no discord. Therefore, we submit that the manner in which the intervention of the minister in university council occurs must not be different to the scenario in the NSFAS board. As such, consistency in these two must be ensured. An example in this case is that Section 41A of Higher Education Act provides for the circumstances in which the minister may appoint an administrator in a university, and these provisions differ in several aspects to the proposed provisions authorizing the appointment of an administrator in the instance of the NSFAS board by the minister. We find difficulty to justify the departure in these two sections, rather the difference in these two sections. Therefore, we submit that although we cannot and do not reject the principle that the minister must intervene in certain circumstances in the NSFAS board and the scheme generally, we, however, staunchly submit that such intervention must allow for an initial independent verification process to establish grounds justifying such an intervention, and such process must be consistent with the processes currently legislated for university councils when administrator is appointed in the Section 41A of the Higher Education Act. The function of the initial independent verification process is to allow for the board access to recourse when the minister develops an opinion and states an intention towards the appointment of an administrator based on conclusion that there is either a financial difficulty or otherwise is guilty, or is guilty in term that board is guilty of mismanagement. Number two, they've acted unfairly or discriminatory or inequitable way or in an equitable way towards a person to whom it owes a duty according to law and is unable to perform its functions effectively. We submit that the reason we make the submission is to clearly deal with the matters of administrative fairness, to also avoid the unintended possibility that the NSFAS board may not have recourse when possibilities of this nature occur. We also provide, I mean, we also agree with the insertion of Section 7, if we've gone to point 4, insertion of Section 7 and its conduct as they relate to the procedure for the removal of the NSFAS board, including the dissolution in the incidence that 75% of members have resigned from that particular council. To provide for an administrator to temporarily take over the management, governance administration in relation to the NSFAS board, that we accept and endorse as correct and acceptable the amendments with the exception of the proposed 17A3A that refers to the maximum time in which an administrator can exercise the conferred authority instead of the proposed 2 years. In terms of that section 17A, we submit that 2 years must be reduced to a year because we find it not totally acceptable that administrators can be have authority to run the scheme for the maximum of 2 years, because we believe that administrators should assume no status of permanency. And if you move it to 2 years, it goes towards that, and we suggest that the maximum time for an administrator, even in the NSFAS board, should be 1 year. That is an issue we approve. On the point that NSFAS has just been presenting on, we find no reason to disagree with the proposal that we put forward. However, we note all the issues that were raised here. In relation to the FET Act proposal, we agree with the majority of them because we think that they are not a new, or rather, they are not provisions that are avoidable. Most of them are a direct consequence of the fact that the FET sector has now been changed to be the competency of the minister. So therefore, the majority of the existing proposals are to ensure that the Act is consistent with that particular change. and it would defy logic to differ with them. On top of that, there is two other parts in the proposed situations of the FET Act that relate to the regulation of members of the board, and that relate to the regulation of members of staff in relation to how council members and staff can relate to the institution in the case of where a conflict of interest in relation to business arises. In the same way, we have submitted to the Higher Education Act amendment. We submit to the FET Act that such a situation must not occur, and that in the final analysis, when it occurs, there ought to be a process that follows in order to prevent such a situation from happening in the future, and to prevent the corruption that is in the present moment ravaging many of these forums. So we thought we should make submissions into those few areas. Without much ado, I think.
Thank you, thank you very much. Any input from members?
Comments on this period of 1 year. There's no problem with the amendment in that they say it must not exceed 2 years. So what is the problem there?
In actual fact, we say that it must not exceed 1 year. This is the logic here. I suppose we must explain it slightly. We are of the view as the organization that administrators in general are one-man shows. If they are one-man shows, they that is a situation that we cannot have it for a long time. And if you say that we must have them for more than 12 months, more than an academic year, for example, more than a financial year, it would mean that we are abdicating the responsibility to appoint fully constituted boards that must function properly, and therefore we're allowing a situation of abnormality, because when boards are appointed, when boards are dissolved and administrators appointed, what is really in action is a situation of intervention arising out of an abnormal scenario, whether it's as maladministration and so on. And to have that for a long time without putting in place proper measures to ensure that there's normality, participation of the stakeholders and so on and so forth, for a maximum of 2 years is too much for us. And we say that it is quite possible for a good administrator to do the work mandated for when appointed by the minister within a year. And we find that we must make that proposal. So we would like to change it to say whatever minimum time, but it cannot exceed 1 year. That is what we are putting forward in actual fact.
Several presentations have come before us relating to the question of conflict of interest. And the presentation came and said, no, you are forgetting one stakeholder, the SRC. You are focusing on members of council, on staff members, but we've got another animal in the house, which is part of organs of governance, the SRC. What was your take on that? Because I think it was a very interesting inclusion by the stakeholders.
In actual fact, Chairperson, unfortunately the staff in your office didn't receive the amended version of the submission, because we say that SRCs are are also supposed to be subject to the same rules. The question of conflict of interest applies to everyone. If we do not want staff members and council members to be corrupted, in the same way we refuse that student representative councils be corrupted, maybe the sooner we do that, the sooner we deal with many other problems in governance of universities. So please count that as included.
Sure. Any further comments, colleagues? Of course, I think we're still going to engage with the department.
Me.
Okay.
Is called your organisation satisfied with the section 23 will be repealed?
If you can remind me.
The question is, you are happy with the repeal of Section 23 of the NSFAS Act, which was allowing NSFAS to actually direct the employer to deduct monies from the salaries of employees indebted to NSFAS. NSFAS has come here, you might have heard them, they say, in fact, we must only refashion this section as to be constitutional, not to repeat it as suggested by the department.
In actual fact, we have put forward here that we unconditionally accept that that amendment. I mean, repeal actually, not an amendment, sorry. Unconditionally.
Are we happy with the... No. I think we must thank SASCO for having come to the committee. We will take into consideration your submissions in conjunction with the rest of the other submissions. There will be debates by the committee on how to finalize these bills. Now we are going to take the next presentation. Thank you for your effort. We are going to call upon the representatives of Stellenbosch University to come forward.
Director for Legal Services at the University of Stellenbosch and representing the university this morning with the submissions. We had earlier provided a more detailed written submission and we were asked to provide a PowerPoint as well. I'll provide the submissions on the basis that both have been read and I'll amplify as required. In general, university supports the objective to address conflicts of interest. Obviously, conflicts of interest is a very difficult concept to manage. It's very wide, it is difficult to define, and it is very difficult to implement and to apply on a practical level. Conflict of interest is also not something that is unique to tertiary education. It is something that one would find in many, many, many spheres. Recently, in financial services, the FSB also issued rules regarding the management of conflict of interest in the delivery of financial services. And it would be quite useful also to consider what they did in that environment, because basic principles would remain the same. If one looks at these amendments, there are probably three main areas of concern that we'd like to bring to the table. The first one is defining the concept of conflict of interest, which we do not see in the rules. Conflict of interest can arise because of a variety of reasons and interests. Those interests could be financial interests, they could be personal interests, or they could be interests relating to equity or some other form of ownership. the application of the conflict of interest would obviously have to refer back to what gave rise to this conflict of interest. If one looks at the next area of concern that we would have is the application of a general prohibition. Having regard to what conflict of interest potentially could be, sometimes it's unavoidable, that conflict of interest. One can't avoid it. What is then required is for the conflict of interest to be managed and mitigated. That management of mitigation could happen through a variety of measures or tools, one of them, and the most obvious one, being disclosure. In all instances, conflict of interest must be disclosed for an authority at a high level to decide whether it's acceptable, whether it's avoidable, and if not, how it can be mitigated through supervision, through sign-off, through division of governance, through division of rules, whatever the case may be. Lastly, if one looks at our last concern is, if there is a conflict of interest at board level or within the tertiary institution, but particularly at board level, what must happen if that conflict of interest is not managed properly, is not disclosed, and there is a consequence? And we find that there is a lack of sanction, particularly regarding the council and council members. Obviously, at the lower level, if one looks at Section 34, staff membership level, your university rules, your labor relationships, that would cater for breaches of something like conflicts of interest. If we look in more detail, meaning of conflict of interest, in our written, in our previous letter, we did provide a definition that potentially could give guidance. And once again, there is no wrong or right definition for conflict of interest. It's such a wide concept, it can be described in many, many ways. But conflict of interest can be described as any situation in which a council member has an interest, including but not limited to any financial interest, non-financial interest, personal interest, or commercial interest, that precludes or may be perceived to preclude that member from acting in the best interest of the public higher education institution. Now, that definition also gives us some idea of why conflict of interest is important. It's important because it goes to the heart of the integrity of the institution. Each one of these interests, being the financial interest, commercial interest, personal interest, whatever the case may be, can and should be defined. And conflict of interest should also include both actual conflict of interest and a potential conflict of interest. As I said, given the wide scope of conflict of interest, a general prohibition becomes both impractical and potentially not required. There are many instances where a conflict of interest is unavoidable. But what should always be required is a disclosure of the conflict of interest and the mitigation of a conflict of interest. One would also need to look at how conflict of interest is managed within any particular institution. And there we would suggest and submit that a policy by an institution to manage conflict of interest in its various forms and in its different places in the university or institution should be in place. That conflict of interest should be supported by supporting processes. And there one would think about processes that are managing the conflict of interest itself, managing conflict of commitment, which is something different to a conflict of interest, a gift policy, that type of thing. Other external supporting processes, and a very important one, would be the procurement process. Because procurement process, to a large extent, would mitigate the risks that may arise from a conflict of interest. If you have a proper procurement process in place, many, if not most, of the risks that arise from conflict of interest could or should be addressed. The application of conflict of interest should be both at the board level and at staff level, as also shown by the amendment, Section 27 and Section 34. But potentially there is a different way in which it would be implemented and managed. At the board level, it would be one of your most important tools for managing conflict of interest would be recusal of a council member from the point of discussion in which that council member may have an interest and therefore a conflict of interest. At university level, at staff level, operational level, it's much more difficult because often the conflict of interest is directly linked to the activity or the responsibilities of that individual member. And in that instance, recusal is often not the answer. but rather disclosure and supervision and division of duties and responsibilities, having someone sign off for the financial implications or financial choices, or having a proper procurement process in place. If one looked at the general prohibition against conflict of interest, there most likely would be unintended consequences. And most likely, a lot of the good will be thrown out with the bad. If one looks at the environment of a tertiary institution, and one looks at research, researchers are dependent on external parties to do their research. They're dependent on external parties to provide funding. Inherently, there is a conflict of interest. And inherently, there's also a conflict of commitment. And maybe just to explain conflict of commitment. Conflict of commitment is different to conflict of interest in that if one looks at somebody who is working, a university professor or other academic at the university, their first responsibility is to the university. If they pick up an external activity, they have approval to do an external activity, which often happens and is good, there potentially is a conflict of commitment, which commitment takes place. And that should be on the assumption and on the guiding principle that your commitment to the university is paramount to your commitment to any outside activity. As I said, sometimes conflict of interest is unavoidable and then it needs to be managed. And sometimes even a conflict of interest may be acceptable under certain circumstances where the greater good for the university trumps any potential conflict of interest on an individual level, with the proviso that it is managed and mitigated properly. Lastly, the sanctions. One needs to consider the sanctions at board level. I think sanctions at university level would already be in place or should already be in place. Those sanctions should include and should provide the board or the council chairperson to have the authority to impose sanctions, or should require that council to have processes in place for sanctions generally, not only regarding conflict of interest, but regarding any other misconduct or other activities that within the board level. Probably the most important to take out of our submission is that conflict of interest is a very difficult concept. It needs to be defined properly. Conflict of interest should be managed within the university at its various levels in terms of a conflict of interest policy, which should be a requirement, and there should be suitable sanctions in place for any breaches. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. number of submissions from and they highlighted the possibility of unintended consequences of the section on conflict of interest. As it stands, they seem to suggest that we should circumscribe its application and so on. Now, what we are so interested in are the scenarios, the practical scenarios that are being experienced in the higher education terrain regarding conflict of interest, so as not to include everything in it. Perhaps you can share with us the sort of enterprises or business relations that arise directly or indirectly between the university and its employees and council members. Because I think what we are looking at here may not be the aspect that maybe your university may preclude your employees to work for another employer, for instance, once the employment relationship subsists. We are looking at a situation where we would not want principal of the university, the spouse of the principal of the university, the chairperson of council, the SRC member, now becoming a tender premier of the university.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes, that's what we are looking at. And now the doctor who came here said, look, the way it is couched at the moment, it might as well exclude a professor had written a research that is universally internalized in universities, and then that will just naturally bring an indirect relationship of a business nature between this professor and the university inventions and all that. What other scenarios do you have which you think we must look at in our intellectual engagement with defining what a conflict of interest is, particularly for this field that we are responsible for?
Thank you. The examples you mentioned regarding research and the commercialization of research and the funding of research are obvious, the obvious examples, and probably the easier ones in which one can identify, disclose, and manage. The more difficult ones probably relate to where there are personal interests, and also where we mentioned in our submission where you could probably get personal interests not only through family members but also through equity relationships, through companies, but also just informal relationships where there's a matter of collusion. The answer to that lies probably not in a general prohibition, but lies in a variety of control measures. And as stated, probably the most important one is disclosure. An example of a very difficult or a more difficult scenario would be where a council member is also a supplier of some other services or goods to the university. Now, potentially, there is a conflict of interest through the council, the individual being a council member as well as a supplier. The answer may not necessarily lie in absolute prohibition, because that could be an above board transaction in that it is the best service at the best price to the university. But obviously there is the risk that it is not at the best price and not the best service that is now being engineered to be accepted as the contract between the university and the third party supplier. A general prohibition would also take away or negate the potential advantageous contract between university and third party supplier. So the answer we would suggest would rather lie in the total process of disclosure at all times, no exception, and then a suitable process of a consideration and approval with control measures such as splitting of functions, and particular having a proper procurement process in place that is entirely removed, which one would accept, from the council or even senior management, but to be found within a particular function subject to certain rules and requirements.
Any further comments and inputs?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lip. Thank you for your presentation. I would just like to know, and your slide is standing there, sanctions. You've said that in terms of your staff, there your options to sanction are quite wide, and you believe that in normal organizations will be dealt with. But as far as your council members are concerned, that seems to be a bit problematic. Now, apart from just raising the issue and saying this may be problematic, would you like to expand as to what you believe possible sanctions should be? And because it seems to me you want us to include reference to sanctions in the legislation.
Yes.
And then also, would you like to criminalize the things like the
breaching of a policy?
That's right. Yeah.
Yes. Maybe to answer the second question first, I don't think criminalization would necessarily be an answer purely for the breach. But obviously, if there was a criminal act involved in the breach, such as bribery, yes, then normal criminal sanctions should follow, but not necessarily because of the breach of the conflict of interest policy, but because of the particular activity. If one looks at sanctions from a council perspective, those sanctions could include ordering of a recusal, suspension, or even debarment of a council member to the council. And that's probably as far as sanctioning should go within the council. If there are other unwarranted or malpractice, such as bribery or other criminal sanction as such, that should be that could potentially be a cause for a complaint by the university with the authorities under a normal action that is already a criminal action.
Just around that aspect before a criminal comes in, here is a very, very short counsel They know the rules. They know when to recuse one another and so on. But they know that today we're going to approve a tender of Mbonjane. It's not announced. It is known only in the heads of these people, and they don't have windows for us to check. But they interact somehow that no, Mbonjane is going to recuse himself because we're going to give him this tender. This year, it is Mbonjane this year. We are a complex council. Mbonjane this year, your tender is 20 billion is yours. Next year is my 10. It's a council, very complex, but advances like you, you know the law, you say, I know the rules, refusal, number one, disclosure, and they follow all that. Now, that's what we want to deal with, complex abuse of entrusted power. Now, that's what I want to deal with.
Okay.
Because, for instance, I hear the newspapers, people are arguing. When Zuma is signing for the tender, they say, look, what's investigating? Because the president has got this power, man. Somehow you could speak to a minister, you might not be in that tender board. That's the debate we're dealing with in higher education ourselves. It is the same situation. That here is a principal with massive power, the chairperson of council, massive power. The chairperson would sit there and say, principal, a person chairing that committee tendering. Go and deal with the situation. Here is the company. That is the reality that we want to deal with. It's not a social question, it's practical.
Understood.
Yes. Let's see how you can help us out of that.
I don't know if there's any one correct answer or one magic wand that one could wave to fix up that. But one would look at a variety, once again, a variety of controls and tools. In the legislation, what one would like to see is a general avoidance provision to address something like that, because what we're talking about is collusion. The person who is the figurehead of the services of goods is recused. He has recused himself. He's playing by the rules. But his friends are sitting in the council, and his friends are strong enough that the council could make some sort of a decision. So a general avoidance provision, at least to strengthen the hand of the authority, in particular the minister, should the minister get to a point to say the whole council is corrupt, or the whole system of the university is corrupt. The other element that one would look to is division of powers. Procurement should not lie at the council level. At most, council could make a final recommendation or final acceptance, but the procurement process within the university, with all its rules and requirements and criteria, is where the process should lie for procurement of goods and services. So the division of power is a very strong control and a very strong tool that would address that particular problem. If the whole institution is so corrupt that the whole council is involved to say, okay, no, never mind what the criteria are, now it is Mr. X's turn to get this type of, and it is his turn to get the financial reward, and it permeates from council through the institution right through to the procurement function, then I think there's reason enough probably for the minister to say, I am now jumping in and placing this university under administration because it is not following its own rules, it is not meeting the requirements of the Act, and generally its practices are not in the interest of the university or the industry as a whole. And its integrity, because at the basis what we're talking about is integrity of the university and integrity of the system, the integrity has now been compromised.
Mine, I think, was also interested in how this whole matter was being taken at a highly intellectual level in terms of all the dimensions that it has. But I'm still convinced that conflict of interest will broadly accommodate any other that you are defining. Because to me, loyalty to this company or that institution and so on, or whether there's ownership and all that, it boils down to conflict of interest. So I thought we need not try, and there are many other definitions, whether it's by commitment, whether it's by ownership or equity, whether it's personal and all, within that, to me, conflict of interest will be broader enough to accommodate almost any of those. But then I wanted to understand if you also believe that we should cascade down this one-on procurement to almost every level, say at the university as an institution. We don't just focus on council, but should go to staff, go to students, go to any other small entity there that deals with issues of procurement. Because to me, we must reach a point where we reach a limit. For instance, you can't say almost everything that is to be procured or purchased by the university should be checked. Well, it may be that some section will be dealing with laundry. It's fine. You may know that this is how big it is financially. You may know that it's not that big, it's small. Whether your statutes by now or policies do address that. But there will be sections that we may not mind what they do. But there will be others that definitely they raise eyebrows. And some by their very nature will be longer. Now, let's take insurance. You insure the buildings, the property in the university. And they're standing there for 50 years, nothing is happening, it's just money going to that insurance. You know, one company, 20 years, still this company that is taking this money, but there's nothing happening in the university. They've even forgotten that they just know the money as it comes. But they don't have service necessarily in that industry, so they're just receiving money. Now, if in the process the son or daughter of that VC is looking for a job, can this person be appointed by that company? Or what is the situation like? Or will they say the conflict of interest? Because now this daughter rose through, got a degree from here, it's an accountant or whatever. But it's now part of that kind of a company. You know. So to me, it will be broad, but we need the core to reach, to get to the core of what will it be to assist the future. So you don't look at everybody and suspect corruption when there's none. You know, it's just in the course of living, in the course of waking, in the course of whatever, there will be some conflict. But where it is very direct, which is, like you said, potential to me can mean anything, you know, but where it's clear that, yes, the direct or indirect one, it can be interpreted to be like that, then you can probably find that these people are in the wrong. I thought that's where we should be going into. But if we broaden it to the extent that it's open-ended, we'll end up holding everybody to the distance. Because then everybody, wherever they are, you know, but we can say, it may not be on the act necessarily, the policies that we're talking about, we can be able to say, from this amount and beyond, we've got interest of any conflict of interest. We want to understand that part. But the other, the sanction that we're talking about, to me, I thought it should be uniform or standard size. So if you then come to say, University of Stellenbosch, should look at what could be their policies in that regard, and only to find that it differs with what the University of Cape Town will do, or Western Cape, or any other university. To me, to some degree, whereas we're giving them power, but you may find that here's 3 months suspension, there's 6 months, there's a year, you know, that kind of thing. You need, to some degree, a situation where you can unify, make that uniform, so that everybody knows that it's an offense if you violated this, and the sanction probably is this in all the universities. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. It's not my intention or my wish that I'd be appearing feverish. I just want to be educated more on the issue of unintended consequences. And then my other question relates to the issue of a clear definition of the conflict of interest. when that definition is brought along, are we not going to be entangled into debates as to its maybe people saying it's too broad, you can't use it, or it's too narrow, others are running away with matter. Are we not going to get into such a situation? Thanks, Chair.
Any further inputs? I want us to round off. That's why I permit people to now engage with this topic. It's just an abstract discourse that somehow tries to solve this issue that we're going to be dealing with.
Yes.
How to define conflict of interest, as people would like us to define that. What elements we must take care of, particularly looking at the education terrain. And so, any further input, colleagues? Or must I allow the presenter to then summarize based on the engagements and then we can continue? Okay.
Should I summarize?
Yeah.
Listening to the comments that have been made, obviously those are the challenges one faces when one manages conflict of interest. At the outset, one should focus on any conflict of interest that would give rise to a problem or concern regarding the integrity of the university. That's as a starting point. It would be very difficult to write rules at any level to manage conflict of interest in all its spheres. The submission would rather be that the Act provides for principles with supporting general rules that could have a general application with certain core criteria. One of those absolute criteria would be disclosure at all times of a potential or actual conflict of interest, so that it is on the table to be managed. The to be managed would have certain criteria of what one would expect our conflict of interest to be managed, written in the laws for the universities to apply at their different levels. One can also take into account that not all universities are at the same level or in the same environment. They have different needs and requirements. Regarding the point of a uniform set of sanctions, one could ask the question, how would this breach of conflict of interest be different to any other breach one would find in a university, and we do not have a uniform set of sanctions regarding all breaches or misconduct within a university. There is a way that these sanctions do measure out and weigh out and eventually do reach a certain level of parity on a like-for-like basis. Once again, universities differ, and they're in different environments, different needs and requirements. Regarding the unintended consequences, some of those unintended consequences, particularly if there's a general prohibition against conflict of interest, is that you will close off those opportunities where the researching obligations and the responsibilities of the university are cut off from external capacity, either through intellectual capacity or organizational capacity or funding. And research is one of the two core activities of a university, the other being education. That research is also a big funder of a university in its pool of financial resources to run the university. That would be a very large unintended consequence, because not every conflict of interest, if viewed against a bigger picture, is necessarily something that must be prohibited. It could be something that is managed, where the conflict of interest at a particular level is managed at a supervisor level. And in that way, the conflict of interest is either taken away or mitigated.
We have come at the end of the presentations, and I should excuse the presenter. Thank you for your time. We'll take all the contributions you made into consideration when we make our final determination of all the matters. I think the department has been here throughout the public hearing. They have had the opportunity to interact with the diversity of thought from various presenters. And I think they also benefited on aspects where the two bills are either inarticulate, uncertain, or overbroad. I mean, somebody was saying in some instances it would appear that the higher education laws amendment bill gives the minister absolute powers. And I was looking at the section as that has been said, where it says where we're dealing with the NSFAS Act, introducing the appointment of the administrator. It says the minister may dissolve the board of the NSFAS under certain circumstances. Now, it doesn't mention which circumstances, for instance. Whether when he is happy or angry, or whether there is corruption or fraud, maladministration, such aspects, you've been able to hear that. So that must be properly clarified. What do we mean by certain circumstances? The minister can intervene, because the law must be very specific and very certain, so that everybody in the country knows that in these circumstances, the minister is coming. It must not just in any circumstance, nobody knows, not even parliament knows, which are those circumstances. And parliament can only pronounce through law. If we will not have a sitting where we say, now we're going to interpret our laws and so on. It is going to be for the judges to do so when there are disputes. So let's look at those. There are aspects that say the bill seeks to empower the minister to direct the board of the NSFAS to take any action specified by the minister. Now, there were arguments that any action, if the minister says, appoint my brother, it is any action. Is that the intention of the legislation? Or what sort of action are we talking about? Are we talking about remedial action? Are we talking about are we talking about? So that this bill, when it comes out, it must be what we think it must be. So that it must not just be a very broad act that ultimately gives the minister what we call absolute powers, which may not be permissible in a democratic scenario. So we need to reflect on those subjects. And we don't have much time. The parliament has been requested to say we must fast track these two bills. And one of the bills must still go to the NCOP. So it would mean that by Friday, when the department or any other date that may be determined by the people who deal with dates of when do we come to such meetings, you are able to have comprehensive answers on everything. So the opportunity is now to go and reflect over this bill. After having had all the submissions and say, here, we can reconfigure this, we can do that before Parliament pronounces. On our side, we deliberately sought the Parliamentary Legal Services to be here, and I also see the state law advisors are here. They are the ones who we are going to depend on to recoin all these sections. Throughout this debate, we've seen where the issues are. We're going to focus on that, where the issues are, and then finalize this matter as urgently as possible. And I would therefore urge members to also take that opportunity to go and sit down with their experts, wherever they find them, to see how we resolve all the aspects that have emerged before us regarding definition of conflict of interest, defining who remains the employer. The department will tell us, are they happy with the colleges being the employer and they also being the employer, two employers, and addressing issue of duality, go and address that. And then you'll advise us, and then we'll be able to proceed on that basis. I would like to take this opportunity to thank members of parliament, all the stakeholders that have taken the opportunity to come before parliament to make presentations, which must be taken into consideration in our final determination of these two bills. I also would like to thank the deputy minister and officials of the department that have been in attendance all throughout proceedings of this session, and officials of parliament and everybody else who has seen it fit to partake in this process. This will signal the adjournment of the meeting. I must indicate that provisionally we are having a meeting on Friday. Provisionally, because we want to check whether they may allow us to have the meeting either on Monday, it may be possible, it may be impossible. So we can't be definite about it. We are coming on Friday. That's what we know. Provisional, meaning that we are coming. Unless they say we don't come, we don't come. But if they say we don't come, it means we are coming.
Chair, I don't know if I'm speaking on behalf of the other members, but if the choice is between Friday or Monday, may we indicate that, in my case, I prefer the Friday before the Monday. I've got certain arrangements, and we were warned about the Friday, so we've already tried to make provision for that.
And we have to make flight arrangements. It's not. When are we going to be informed whether it's going to be Friday or Monday?
Whatever is to be done, Chair, if you were to commit yourself that by end of today, then members will be informed when is exactly the day. But we have had sentiments here, so that we know tomorrow is Thursday, Friday.
Yeah, it's clear, colleagues, and it's clear that tomorrow we are not coming. That is Thursday. It is clear that we are coming on Friday and possibly Monday. Now, that is what is clear. So there won't be any announcement. We are definitely coming. For the department, they are coming Friday, Monday. They are here. They are already dealing with this act. Tonight, I'm sure they'll be applying their minds on all the issues. Friday, 9 o'clock. Half past nine. Why not 9 o'clock? So that we can finish earlier, if possible. We've got a very strong legal team there. The way they are so empowered, they will just be taking us through and probably finish very early. Yes. I'm trying to suggest that you say something about.
Among the only one who prefers Monday.
People support your proposal of Friday.